You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. This is Bennett Kelly. We're broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in Santa Monica in the heart of Silicon Beach. Please be seated. We got another great show for you today. Our guest today is Alvin Felsenberg, and he is the author of A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley. And it has a cover has a photo of him and Governor Reagan, and the two actually are very much intertwined. But we'll get that in a minute. Mr. Felsenberg, are you with us?
Yes, I'm right here, Bennett. Delighted to be with you.
And this book you said was somehow it was like 7 years in the making. Yes. What led you to decide to write this book?
Well, I was teaching a class at the University of Pennsylvania, Annenberg School for Communication. And I had just gone back to teach work at the 9/11 Commission where I was. And I started the very week that he passed away. I thought I would ask my students what they knew about him. Well, they all heard of him. That made me very happy. And knew about him very little. So I said, how can that be? And they said, well, when he passed away, remember firing line, this is 2008, firing line had already been off the air over 10 years. So the eldest one would have been about 12. So I understand why they didn't remember much, but they said that they were pounded with email blasts that this man had died. And he got the kind of coverage that only ex-presidents and rock stars get. And I said, well, a cross between an ex-president and a rock star sounds like Bill Buckley to me.
It kind of was,
I thought it would be fun bringing him back to them. Because I don't remember a time where public discourse on television reached such an elevated plane. I don't know too many people who have spontaneous wit without ghostwriters and all of that. And I thought that there was a lesson in his story. That's why I read it.
So when people ask you today who are unfamiliar with Bill Buckley or William Buckley, what do you say?
I say many things. That he was certainly the founder of the post-World War II conservative movement, as we know it. We can talk about that. He spent the better part of a half century bringing that movement, I would say, the fringe of the American political perspective right to the center, where it became one of two competing political philosophies. But more than that, as a communicator par excellence, he occupied every forum that was available to him in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, before Facebook and before Twitter and before all the modern gadgets and avenues we have. He dominated print. He was the first modern-day conservative syndicated columnist for 33 years. He had a long-running show on PBS, which most people knew him, called Firing Line. He wrote fiction, novels. He went on television. He went on Woody Allen, had a comic show for a while. He went on Roland and Martin's Laugh-In.
It's like it to me.
Johnny Carson, you name it. And my favorite is, we're talking to a studio based in California, and your listeners might appreciate that he's the only journalist I know who managed to make a Disney movie in animated form. William F. Buckley appears in Aladdin in an animation narrated by Robin Williams. So when he would go to airports, he would get autograph seekers, very much like a rock star or an ex-president. So I thought it's a good comparison.
It's interesting. You didn't say, read my book.
the book is called, thank you, A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. Yale University is my publisher.
I was just joking when I said, when people ask you who was Buckley, you should first say, well, first read my book. But any event.
Thank you, Bennett. I'm going to take you on my tour. I have to do several stops in California. So
there we go.
Bring you along.
There we go. So, it's interesting, hearing your discussion and your description of, how would you describe him? And here's a quote I saw from a National Review article after his death from called The Irreplaceable William F. Buckley. And it makes an important point. It says, it's important to remember that when National Review was founded, Buckley was the leader of a fringe movement. He made conservatism respectable again after the Great Depression and Second World War had delegitimized it. His prominence was due not only to his energy, diligence, and charisma, but also to his novelty and his impudence. I wanted to hear what he had to say because no one else was saying it. In the world of I Like Ike, the New Frontier and Great Society, no similarly situated member of New York elite held this then outlandish view of the role of government, academic freedom, the place of religion in public life, and confrontation with the Soviet Empire. His courage shifted the intellectual and political landscape. So, let's start, I guess, with his emergence in the post-war era. Because World War II for Buckley, but not necessarily for all conservatives, kind of changed the landscape of their political viewpoint.
Well, when Buckley was born, remember, 1925, Calvin Coolidge was in the White House. Governments were small. Federal government had a very small role. We had come out of World War I, disillusioned from foreign adventures. And the country was pretty much at peace. People's heroes were in the private sector, Henry Ford and Thomas Edison and others I could name. And in his lifetime, two calamities occurred that put an end to everything I just described. Obviously, the Great Depression and the coming of the New Deal, which greatly strengthened the role the federal government played in economic affairs of the country and in public affairs. And, of course, World War II, where this time, sadly, we were unable to bring all the soldiers home permanently. A Cold War started very, very soon. The nation was always in perpetual conflict with the Soviet Union. Both of those were tremendous leaps forward for big government. Buckley was the only one, the most visible one, I'll say, and the most energetic one, rowing in another direction, yes. Opposite of the New Frontier and the Great Society, and certainly opposite of Ike. Although he said that he really did not originate a great number of political ideas, what he's trying to do is bring back into vogue certain principles that had been long forgotten in the interregnum decades that I just described. And they were decentralized government, limited government, checks and balances, respect for separation of powers and the Constitution's put on presidential war making and other things, and a great respect for the Judeo-Christian tradition, which he said inspired the founding fathers and made us who we are. He had complete contempt for what he called moral equivalency, that basically all ideas are equal and have equal value and there's no eternal truth. The real Bhakti, there were eternal truths, and there were some things you don't give on. And I described some of those things. I can describe some more. But yes, and he was, in many ways, classed by himself.
And so that's one thing he's credited with, is kind of this fusion of basically, you know, laissez-faire economics and, you know, anti-communism plus a certain, you know, traditional values approach to conservatism that I'm assuming was part Catholicism.
Partly driven by his Catholicism, partly driven by his love of history.
And
go ahead.
There seems to be this a turning point for the GOP, and it comes with when Eisenhower is running for president, and that you have a chance at regaining the White House after losing five straight elections, and the issue is, Eisenhower, I've heard you talk about this, is, Eisenhower was willing to support Taft as long as Taft supported NATO, and Taft wouldn't. And so that thrust him into the ring. And but he was not, a traditional conservative ruler. And so had Taft merely supported NATO, that would have been something that Buckley would have been fine with. But instead, I think the emergence of Ikeism, for lack of a better term, seemed to push him into, launching National Review.
Yes, in some ways, Ike was the silent founder of National Review. Buckley had no small ambition. After he took on Yale University, which we can talk about later, political correctness, as your listeners might know it, Plus Sachans in New Haven, by the way, still going on. But nevertheless, he said he would settle for nothing less than reading Dwight Eisenhower out of the Republican Party and out of the conservative movement. Boy, that's one tall order going against the man who put together the largest military armada in the history of the world.
Right.
Well, remember, there were some parallels here. For 20 years, Republicans in congressional and presidential elections talked about repealing the New Deal.
Right.
And repealing, cutting
familiar.
Back on entitlements, balancing the budgets, yes. And, and finally, they of the president and both houses of Congress, and Ike makes it very clear that that's not going to happen. Ike was of the view that governments cannot proceed faster than their constituencies would allow. And that would have been so great a shock to the American system that would never be heard of again. And the conservatives would get the worst thing possible. They would get another activist Democratic president who would take the New Deal farther, but that the strong anti-communist foreign policy that Ike used to keep the peace with the Soviets. Buckley was of a different view, and he probably could have tolerated a Democrat continuing to do damage as long as the right was united. But here was another man, probably the most famous and most admired man on the world, Dwight David Eisenhower, calling himself a conservative because of his anti-communist views, because of his strong military background, and because of a penchant for balancing the budget. I mean, Ike was perfectly willing to slow down the increase of spending, but he was not willing to unearth major people had grown accustomed to. That started a major war, all by little old self. Bill Buckley started the last civil war in the Republican Party. The idea was to create a conservative party, with all liberals on one side and all conservatives on another. We call it realignment of the two parties. So our politics would be neater, and we could hold people accountable. Well, I was just reminiscing about the time FDR thought he could do the same thing. That he didn't want the Southern Democrats slowing down the New Deal, and he was going to purge them all. And of course, Mr. Bannon talks about that today, and a former advisor of President Trump.
Right.
Wants to primary number of senators who aren't helping the administration. Well, FDR didn't succeed, but Buckley did succeed. And California helped him succeed. We had a major showdown in the California primary in 1964 between Nelson Rockefeller, who was the perceived establishment candidate, Eastern, pro-New Deal, pro-big government programs, and Barry Goldwater, who very much, in spite of his anti-communism on many things, was very much a libertarian, perhaps the most libertarian candidate who ever ran. He called Ike's administration a dime steal. In other words, we're getting the same progress. I would have loved that, by the way. and Goldwater won the California primary by a very narrow margin. And everybody thought that his nomination would be a fluke, that after he was defeated by Johnson in an overwhelming landslide, the largest up to that point in American history, that normalcy will prevail and the two parties will continue to go along, Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Well, didn't happen. You had a major realignment of the two parties. The South, which had been long the Democratic Party's base, became Republican, where it is to this day. Northeast, which had been rock-ribbed Republican, turned Democratic, and was still very much, until the election of Trump, and even after, still living in that world. So I would say that after Ike, you did get Buckley Stream, and all that agitation let conservatives actually organize. Remember Goldwater's great speech in 1960 when the right tried to draft him. Instead, the party went to Nixon, was, you know, grow up conservatives. I mean, go to work. Try to take the party over. Run for local office. Do this kind of things, which some Democrats from Hillary on Clinton down are urging young progressives to do. So it kind of tells you we've been here before.
And in taking over, he obviously was not one to be shy in his opinions. He called Eisenhower a man who was undaunted by principle, unchained by any coherent ideas as to the nature of man and society.
No Democrat ever said that.
and that's someone who's technically on the same side of him politically, but actually some of his fiercest comments were towards fellow members of the or non-Democrats, I should say, to other libertarians and other people conservative viewpoints. And early on, one of the first people he takes on.
Let me take some of these one by one. Buckley said that he wanted his legacy to be that he cleansed the conservative movement. Kooks, racists, anti-Semites. Let me just say the
which category with Ann Randy.
he would have thought a kook. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
But your comment about Ike. Those were, Buckley really thought that of Ike. I mean, he took Ike at face value. And there was a great deal going on in the Eisenhower presidency that he missed and many other people missed that we can come back to. But he wasn't attacking Ike's character. He was attacking Ike's lack of conservatism and his inability to give articulate speeches, which was one of Ike's defects. Buckley worshipped the English language. In terms of speechifying, a word Lyndon Johnson loved to use, Buckley's model was Adlai Stevenson. In terms of politics, his model was Taft. But let's talk about Ayn Rand. Buckley considered himself a libertarian because we are supposed to keep our assets, as many as we can, to redeem society, to help society, to give back. To give to hospitals, to give to schools, to give to art museums. God created man in his image, Buckley said, and allowing him to perfect his talent, whether he be a Da Vinci or an Einstein or a Mozart, and that enriches us all. And without God, without obeying the commandments, and libertarianism in his view became libertinism and hedonism. That's why I said he would have. She wrote a book called The Art of Selfishness, which the whole title and the whole concept appalled him. But when Buckley wanted to nuke somebody, you know, they didn't just do it the way we do it today. He didn't write a negative review about the shrug. He didn't go on TV and just say, I don't like the book, which he did do, too. He commissioned Whitaker Chambers, probably at that time, the most known anti-communist. Whitaker Chambers exposed the treachery of Alger Hiss at the State Department. Hiss was considered a likely Secretary of State or Secretary General of the United Nations, and he was accused by Whitaker Chambers of having been a Soviet agent all the time that he was advising Franklin Roosevelt on foreign policy. So Whitaker Chambers was the most revered and known anti-communist of the era. He commissioned Chambers to do a cover story for National Review attacking Rand. The cover was replace the golden calf of biblical days with the dollar sign, and all these people are bowing down to it. And this was, in his view, where Randianism would take it. In the article, suggested that her runaway capitalism with no constraints and her division of the world between users and takers and creators, or makers and takers, those kinds of words, and that half the population were drags on the rest of it, was nothing more than a rekindled fascism. I'm quoting Chambers, not me, now. And her atheism is what bothered Buckley the most. I mean, the idea was we were gifts and our fruits of our labor to create, to glorify God, to improve society. And we can do a better job than bureaucrats can. It's not here just to have great fun for ourselves and forget about posterity and the rest and community. Being a Catholic, he's also very communitarian. He tithes, as the Bible says, and naturally, the more money you can keep, the more money you can tithe. And again, decisions can be made closer to home and by people, not by governments. So that was his rift with Rand. Yes, he was the first one on the right. She was the first one on the right that he took on.
Rand, do you believe Rand still has a strong hold on libertarian thought today?
Absolutely. Our current Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, ran for vice president on Mitt Romney's ticket. He said that Ayn Rand had a greater influence on him than any other writer that he'd read growing up. He considers himself very much a Randian, but not an atheist, but he is in that camp.
But Ryan's also Catholic.
He is also a Catholic, and perhaps he has would share some of Buckley's criticisms of Rand on those grounds. But he has said on economics, anyway, that he found her a great influence. Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve and a genius economist, was a follower of Rand growing up. I suspect we have many members of the Republican Congress.
Right.
Maybe some of them consider themselves libertarian and have read her books. Others have absorbed it. I'm talking about the Freedom Caucus now, which are Republicans who tend to vote against any budget or any compromise deal on anything. Nothing's perfect. Some of them would quote Rand. Some of them maybe picked her ideas up from others. So, yes, libertarianism is very popular with young people. Reason Magazine seems to be doing all right. They have some of the brighter columnists competing. You have the Cato Institute. Yes. When you walk to the Cato Institute, and I mean this with no ill intent, memorial, except instead of having quotes from Abraham Lincoln, they have quotes from Rand embossed on the wall. I don't know if it's marble or not, but yes, they're a very successful and prosperous Washington think tank. So yes, her ideas live. But Buckley always said he was libertarian. He just couldn't abide the atheism, which creates selfishness and the lack of the time with God and reflecting our gifts as God intended us to use them and develop them. Yes. But he economically, the less government did, the better, he thought.
Well, we need to take a moment of reflection for our sponsors. And so we'll be kind of merging both Buckley and Rand. But we'll be back after these messages.
You're listening to
to Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Is your website hacked? Is your website displaying error messages or loading slowly? Even if there are no signs of malicious activity, your site may still be compromised. Websites, like cars, require regular maintenance to perform at their best and not leave you stranded. At Fjorge, our website maintenance experts can help you assess which one of our maintenance plans will best support your needs. Visit fjorgedigital.com or call 612-877-3840 and get the support and protection your website and business deserve. That's fjorgedigital.com.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
There are over 70 million active podcast listeners in the U.S.
WebmasterRadio.fm reaches them all
with the largest global distribution of any online business-to-business podcast network. Through iHeartRadio, iTunes, Stitcher, we can target and place your message in front of those active listeners immediately. Now, your message can be delivered with less commitment and investment on over 20 hours of weekly original content.
Hosted by the most respected names in digital marketing.
Email sales at webmasterradio.fm today and get your message delivered now.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking to Alvin Felsenberg, author of A Man and His Presidents. And Mr. Felsenberg, as he mentioned earlier on, had served as a spokesman for the 9/11 Commission. He's also served in the presidential administrations as advisors to both the State and Defense Department. And you were the spokesman, or are you still the spokesman for the Joint Economic Committee?
No, I left at the end of 2015.
Okay. And which administrations were you in the State and Defense Department?
George Herbert Walker Bush and George Bush the Younger. And I was a great fan of Ronald Reagan. In the Ronald Reagan days, I was working in state government for Thomas Kane, governor of New Jersey, as assistant secretary of state. But I was always a great fan of Ronald Reagan.
And Thomas Kane, who most people won't remember, but he had the to counter the I Love New York campaign. I remember they had the New Jersey campaign with his unique accent. He and Yule, perfect together. And I can't really mimic it, but he did have his own unique accent. But
He's a marvelous man. He went on firing line a few times, and he was one of New Jersey's great governors. And Buckley wrote a great column about him. Tom was one of the first to say that schools should be regarded as something that, let's say, a commodity or a service we provide parents and children, not holding bins for children who are sentenced to go to schools where they were born or where they live. And if the government can force Southern governors out of school door houses to let people in, then governors can make sure that the standards are improved and they meet them in the state. And Buckley said that was the first act that might eventually lead to school of choice. But it was first governor he knew that actually said what's going on is not going to be accepted. So he was a marvelous governor.
And anyways, you mentioned the issue of, you know, governors and schoolhouse doors. And that, that's an important point in Buckley's career.
Yes.
You know, he famously a column in the 50s, Why the South Must Prevail. And but over time, you know, becomes repelled by, you know, the Southern obstructionists of, you know, George Wallace in particular. And then as you write, because of he was really torn after the 16th Street Baptist Church bombings, which now actually is becoming part of the political parlance, because the man who prosecuted just recently, who prosecuted the people who did that bombing, is running for Senate in Alabama against Judge Roy Moore. So the very topical issue in an odd sense. But to explain Buckley's evolution from Why the South Must Prevail to being anti-George Wallace.
There's no question those articles are very hard to take. Even in the 50s, he went farther than most of us who think we're conservatives went. He didn't have to. So why did he write? He wrote it. He also said the South must prevail because the white race was the more developed race. Until that changes, they should be in control for perpetuity of their society. Well, Buckley, on both sides of his family, was the son of Bourbon. I call them Bourbon Democrats. They were the genteel noblesse oblige inheritors of the planter class, shall we say. Mm-hmm. We knew some of them in our time. Even Southern liberals tended to be segregationists. Remember Sam Ervin, the Watergate Committee fame,
right.
Just cut the lawyer. Well, he agrees that presidents who misbehave should be disciplined, but he also was the author of the Southern Manifesto, which Southerners took a pledge to repeal the Brown decision by all legal means. So that was Ervin. Senator Fulbright, who was known Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman of the Senate as a sage on Vietnam, but also
author of The Arrogance of Power.
The Arrogance of Power, that's right. Crippled Giant, in several of these books. But John Kennedy couldn't make him Secretary of State because he knew there'd be a fight with the NAACP, and he thought the first Catholic president should not start off with that kind of a controversy. Well, so that's where Buckley came from. But over time, that class of Southern politics, and Richard Russell, they started losing power to groups that Buckley called welfare populists. Now, these were people that attacked the other rulers for not being tougher on blacks, and they race baited in what we call the Democratic primaries. And one by one, these populists took over. Now, these populists may have not wanted to allow blacks to go to the same schools as whites and all the rest of that, but they had no problem taking federal money and everything else. And when Buckley had Wallace on the show, he called him a fraud. He said, you know, Lyndon Johnson is paying for 60% of your budget, your highways, your roads, and even your segregated schools, which you won't let people attend if they're not white. And he said, I don't want those programs. You see that Buckley's still a libertarian, but I don't want any racial tests over who they benefit. Well, but the change came earlier, as you say. And a lot of that is Catholic tradition. There's no question about that. The fact that these four girls in the Birmingham, Alabama, were killed on a Sunday morning wearing their Sunday best, praying and attending Sunday service and Sunday school. And this is all a week after the March on Washington, which many of us still see after the Civil Rights Movement. A week after that miraculous speech Cain gave, and after some discernible change in public attitude, we had this bombing. And he held Wallace personally responsible for that, wrote a piece on it, and said his rhetoric certainly unearthed the beast that did this heinous deed. And he doesn't quite say that he wants the federal government or of civil rights, but he stops defending the old order. And he kind of says that unless the South changes on its own, they're going to bring about or invite the worst solution possible, which they thought was federal intervention. So his columns begin to read less as criticisms of Johnson and others who wanted to intervene, but lectures to the South that if you don't change, I'm going to get out of the way, and the right should get out of the way, and nature will take its course. By the time he went to mayor of New York in 1965, Buckley is the first conservative I know, maybe the only one, who came out for affirmative action. He said, listen, white-controlled institutions have kept African-Americans in a dire situation by intent, by law, by society, and those white institutions are going to have to take a more active role in bringing them up to equality, to equal standards. Almost the opposite view that he had when he wrote it. So it took a long time, and he still believed in market-based solutions and, you know, community power, you know, answers to questions. I slipped here and said community power. I say that because during the Nixon years, Buckley was one of about 25 white journalists sent on a tour of urban America. And they visited Watts. They visited Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Washington. And he met with several young black, they called them at the time, black militants, followers of Stokely Carmichael.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I don't understand why they're criticized so much. They sound like the young me. They don't like federal intervention. They don't like bureaucracy. They want community control of the schools. They're pointing out certain corruption in the police departments. And he said, you know, they sound like the young me. What do they hate? Federal intervention. What do they hate? One size meets all. What do they criticize? Insensitive bureaucracies. Don't know their neighborhoods and their streets and their children. And he said, but for the accident of birth and circumstance, I could have been they and they could be me. That really opened his eyes. And by the early mid-70s, he writes a piece for Look magazine saying that he wouldn't be surprised if the United States elected a black president by 1980. Now, he might have been a generation early here, but the kind of person he described, he said, would come out of those community organizations. So when I slipped and said community organizer, Buckley, that kind of a person would become president. And of course, he may or may not have had he lived. But Obama certainly did. He certainly met that criteria, even if the two men would have had differences on economic policy.
Neither Buckley nor Look magazine lived to see that
right.
day.
But, That's right. I miss Look magazine.
So, in 1960s, so let's go back. In the 50s, he launches National Review and quickly becomes an important source of conservative thought. And then in the 1960s, he begins Firing Line on PBS, which is, you know, there's a certain irony there since PBS is a great society program.
Yes.
But here he is. You know, using it to continue his, you know, promoting his agenda. Although he, you know, it wasn't a strictly a conservative show, since he, you know, frequently had, you know, those with other views, and in fact enjoyed that very much.
Yes. One of his critics said that William F. Buckley Jr. would rather argue than eat. The chance of having a debate show. But he was pretty shrewd, and the idea for the show was this should be one place conservatives and liberals come together. And I want the liberals to watch me, but the hook is if they want to hear John Kenneth Galbraith for a half hour, they have to listen to me for a half hour. Those are the dues you have to pay. And my people would only watch me if I just had my own show, and I don't want that. I want our people to hear their views challenge and criticize and see that they can take scrutiny in the public square. So there was a time when Meet the Press was the only real show on Sunday morning that really probed these issues. Some
right.
people used to call it the Russert primary. In other words, if the presidential candidate can make it out of the Russert primary alive, then he's ready for New Hampshire. Well, They didn't call it the Buckley primary, but there was. I mean, every presidential candidate wanted to go on because of Buckley's viewership and Buckley's capacity to debate. And if they could get through that, they were considered a heavyweight. Now, only one presidential candidate absolutely refused to go on the show, and that was Buckley. And Buckley handed a public telegram that probably did more damage than any debating point might have. The telegram was one-liner, and it said, "Why does the baloney reject the grinder?" So that was short enough to put on a bumper sticker or hold up at the Kennedy rallies and rile him a little bit. But that's the one that didn't go on. They all thought they had to go on. They fought to get on.
And one person who did go on was, and even before he was in elected office, was Ronald Reagan.
Oh, yes. Reagan was on several times. In fact, the cover photograph that shows Buckley and Reagan, I think Reagan has been governor of the state of California for all of 3 months when he was on. It was 67. And it was the first season of Firing Line.
And in fact, I think he called Reagan governor before he was governor. And I think he was writing to him before he was president and making reference to that. But in addition, Reagan clearly benefited, I think, from the exposure on Frontline. But there was recently a movie that was released, Best of Enemies.
Uh-huh, yes.
And I don't know what you thought of it. It was a documentary of that period.
Yes.
And in his famous clashes with Gore Vidal at the 1968 Democratic and Republican conventions. And I saw one article that actually said that was the beginning of the decline of our is kind of public discourse. That's when brash kind of combat debate took over rather than more genteel reason debate.
Right. Well, first of all, I recommend that film, Best of Enemies, to anyone interested in the era. Both Buckley and Vidal should be studied, and both, I hope, will be read for a long time. But I would say I don't agree with that conclusion for a couple of reasons. That outburst was not calculated. That's the only time Buckley lost his temper in public and would never do so again. He received a lot of fan mail from people saying, "Well, I'm finally glad you put that fellow in his place." And he would write them back saying, there's nothing to be proud of in losing your temper in public. And he never talked about it again. And we never saw that kind of, let's say, smash mouth in civil on TV, at least from him. I think when Crossfire came on and other things and things you see on cable, these are almost planned food fights.
Right.
So what created the Buckley outburst? Well, people forget this, too. World War II was only over for 22 years or so. It wasn't that long ago. So 25 years ago, we're back in the Clinton administration. So you see, it's not that far back.
Right.
Okay. So 1968, a number of Holocaust survivors were making their way in mid-careers in the United States. Some were elderly, but we didn't quite talk about it as much. It wasn't until there was a miniseries in the 1970s called Holocaust with Joan Fontaine and some others. Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me fine?
Hello?
Yeah, okay. Yes, I can hear you.
Not till that series, the word even used to mean all those atrocities. Well, these people are listening to the set, and they hear a known playwright and author, and wrote the screenplay for Ben-Hur, which is also the movie Ben-Hur, and a bit of a bon vivant, announces William F. Buckley Jr., his rival here, is a crypto-Nazi. He's not even a Nazi, doesn't wear a uniform, but he's burrowing in the world of communications to push Hitlerianism. That's what he said to him. And in 1968, that was perceived as a career ender. Buckley had been called, and many conservatives had been called fascist and worse. Goldwater certainly was, and he ran for president. And in Buckley's life, he had sued other people for that and gotten a retraction from them. So the Badal was like one of a long line, but this had been coming for some time. If you're watching the debates, they were baiting each other. They did not like each other, and that's very sad. But when he lit that match, knowing Buckley's record having been called out by others and being litigated, and won some of those litigations, Buckley just exploded. And he very much regretted that. And he said some things he shouldn't have in the context of the times. But I would say the slur that he used, gay rights had not come into its own yet. Gore Vidal never acknowledged that he was gay. He wrote about gay things, which he said was autobiographical. And many people on the left, including some folk singers, anti-war demonstrators, said many things that we in our ears would take now as homophobic and sexist and many things like that. That's not to excuse anything that happened on the set, but I would say Buckley was ashamed of that outburst. Never happened again. And while we did see a lot more food fights on television, we never ever saw it from him. So that's where I part company. But I recommend that film wholeheartedly. It captures the era exceptionally well.
I saw the trailer. It really seemed to have a lot of spice to it. And certainly, it was 1968 when the whole world just seemed to be on fire. Yeah. And
that's correct.
Definitely worth reviewing. Now, Buckley, as we mentioned, was an early Reagan supporter. And in the 1980, Reagan wins. And some people saw Reagan's election as, in some ways, the culmination of the kind of almost to go French on you, you know, the raison d'etre of why the National Review was founded. This was really what Buckley had set out to do all along.
Yes. You can't get more mainstream and more establishment than the President of the United States. Had a role in creating that press. Reagan said that no one did more to bring the Reagan presidency into fruition than William F. Buckley Jr., and that includes Ronald Reagan, said Ronald Reagan. Reagan, when he started reading National Review, Reagan was going through a series of changes. His acting career had been finished, pretty much washed up. He managed to land a job as a promoter for General Electric products that sent him along around the country. Progress is our business was their motto. And he hosted something called General Electric Theater, which was on right opposite Ed Sullivan. And he had these morality tales and homilies at the end of each of these skits. And they were about a half hour, an hour dramatic presentation. He was reading National Review all through those days, and he knew Buckley from that more than Buckley knew Reagan as an actor. I mean, Buckley did not spend his Saturday afternoons as a child watching Reagan's B movies, Bedtime for Bonzo, and all the rest. He had other things going on, but Reagan was reading Buckley. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
No, I was going to say you never know.
Don't let me.
You never know.
Well, so as the Bible says, nothing new under the sun. So Buckley was asked to address a anti-Medicare, what we can now call Medicare rally in Los Angeles at a public high school at night. And he's having dinner with his wife, Buckley is, and the Reagans are leaving and they stop at Buckley's table. And Reagan says, excuse me, Mr. Buckley, I'm Ronald Reagan and I'm introducing you tonight. Oh, pleased to meet you. You know, meet my family, meet my blah, 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 blah. And he says, well, before I leave you alone, I just want to tell you, I just finished reading your Up From Liberalism book, and I loved your presentation on Eleanor Roosevelt. And out he goes. And, you know, Buckley is just literally mesmerized. I mean, this is no Hollywood actor, as I've been led to think about them, he thought. This is no airhead actor. This guy prepared, disciplined. He reads And he said he read, he was my best, you know, so he's thinking all this to himself. And then a series of things happened in the book. A friendship begins, both with Reagan and Buckley, and between Nancy Reagan and Buckley. And by the time Reagan becomes president, Buckley does cross a tender line here between analysts and political consultants under the behind the scenes. Wherever Reagan gets into trouble, particularly with a public relations brouhaha or so, Buckley is a one-man fire department. He's sending him speeches. He's recommending people to the administration. The people who wrote Reagan's most memorable speeches were all people Bell recommended. Had a hand in the Evil Empire speech and the Ash Heap of History speech, which are two in which he denounced Soviet tyranny. And Peter Robinson, who's now at the Hoover Institution,
wrote
the context and the line, "Tear down this wall." So, I mean, without Buckley's influence, you know, the Reagan star would be a little less bright. They called each other constantly. And Christopher Buckley said that, you know, well, his father was, you know, obviously an actor, and actors are supposed to be extroverts. He didn't have that many close personal friends. Buckley was the only significant male friend he had. And George Will said that, he had one best friend in his life, and he married her. Ronald and Nancy. But in terms of you know, male guys he'd lay his hair, you know, let his hair down with, it was Bill. And they talked about raising their children. They talked about other dreams that they had in and outside of politics. They went on vacations together. And I can't overstate the role Nancy Reagan played in facilitating all of that. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that Reagan might say to me, there you go again, because we just have to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll be wrapping up with Alvin Felsenberg and a man and his president.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
WebmasterRadio.fm is the destination for education, entertainment, and engagement. Engage with our panel of on-air experts and peers by following us on Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and LinkedIn. You can listen to WebmasterRadio.fm on air or on demand from our website or through iTunes, Stitcher, or however you get your podcasts. Interact and stay informed. Just search for WebmasterRadio.fm.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. Top SEOs send you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let Top SEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
Looking for a better way to get more traffic and interaction to your Facebook page? Imagine Facebook interactivity on your page like you've never seen. Introducing your new Facebook marketing fix, ZoSocial, the new and revolutionary way to easily manage and automate your Facebook contests and sweepstakes. Create a fun, easy-to-win contest by writing a simple Facebook post. Watch your post go more viral and generate loads of interaction. Track your traffic and generate email lists with ease. ZoSocial is mobile-friendly and complies with Facebook terms of service. Let ZoSocial give your Facebook page some flash today. Zoom over to ZoSocial.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
Okay, and we're back, and we're talking with Alvin Felsenberg on Man as President, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Yale Books. And it's been an interesting discussion. Now, the state of his movement after Buckley is an interesting right. topic, and you know, we probably don't have too much time to explore. But you know, Buckley, before his death, I mean, and a decade before his candidacy, was quite blunt about the current president, calling him a narcissist and really in the kind of the worst, the antithesis of really what National Review have been trying to build. You know, what does the progression from Reagan to Trump say about the movement?
Well, the movement is fraying, let's put it that way. After the passage of time and the passage of great leaders, up the remains, and some Buckley supporters are actively supporting Trump. Some who are in CPAC, which is a group that allows presidential candidates and other conservatives a voice, and their leadership seems to be very pro-administration. Others, National Review, most of the staff, and George Will, take a different view of the administration. They support certain policies of it, but not its style necessarily. And of course, Bill Kristol, who Buckley influenced greatly, is leading the anti-Trump factions or whatever there are. I would say it's very hard to say what someone who's no longer with us would be saying now. And he did say Trump was a narcissist. He did say he was a narcissist. He worried about the cult of personality, which he saw happen everywhere. Although he once said that he would rather be governed by the first 1,000 names in the Boston phone book than by the first 100 names in the Harvard faculty directory. He was very skeptical of populism and very skeptical of unchecked democracy. What he meant by that was the mob. What he meant by that was appealing to the base instincts of the public. He was not a great...
And that's what bothered him about Wallace, too.
Very much.
Yeah.
The guttural of Wallace, the appealing to baser instincts. Wallace used to say that the people lay down in front of his car to protest, they'd never walk again. He'd hit the gas pedal, the crowd went nuts, sort of thing. Did not like that. It reminded him of the mobs in Europe. And so I guess what he would say, it's hard to say that, but I will. I'll venture it. If there are things that we fought for all of our lives, like tax cuts, by all means, we should support those kinds of things because we think that's good policy. On the other hand, the most important thing we have are the things I started this interview with, constitutional government, constraining authority, checking runaway presidents, checking commitment of troops without debate, without authorization of Congress, elevating the public debate, and above all, constitutional rule. And I guess he'd be on one track. Vote for the things that we believed in if it's being proposed. On the other hand, we're not giving up these guarantees for convenience. Conservatives can abuse power just like liberals are. And then we have the whole other debate on whether and on what issues the current administration would be conservative. All Buckley's life, he was a free trader, for instance. He was an early promoter of NAFTA. In fact, he lost many donors who were on the right and were protectionists when he embraced NAFTA under Bill Clinton's time. And he lost many other Republicans and conservatives when he broke with George Bush on Iraq. His view on Iraq was, I believe in saving the American people. And if you believe that, on good information, that Saddam was building a nuclear bomb and was prepared to use it, you had every right to go in. But I draw the line at this nation building. What are we doing here 7 years after we said we had won this war? And no. They're doing what they would be doing if we left, which is basically engaging in their own civil and religious war.
Right.
And we shouldn't be doing this all around the world. So in other words, without the Soviet
Union, I'm afraid I have to cut you off. We're running out of time. You're speaking on Saturday, November 18th at the Miami Book Fair on the panel on American presidents. It's in room 8203. Are there any other appearances you want to plug before we run out of time?
Well, for those in California, I'm going to be at the Nixon Library on the 6th of December. I'm doing a few things in New York between then and now, but I would say that I'm planning my California trip, and we hope to do the Reagan Library at some point too.
That'd be great, and I look forward
to the Miami Book Festival.
Great. And if you do come to California, I look forward to meeting you. That's all we have for now. Thank you very much for joining Alvin Felsenburgh, A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley. Be sure to catch him at the Miami Book Fair panel on American presidents. And this is Bennett Kelly. Thank you for joining us. We will see you next week. Thanks for listening to CyberLaw Business Report. For information on today's show, check out our show notes at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com. Have a good week. Thank you.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.